Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give, and there is no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off, and every now and then, or once every time you listen, it's really up to you. Click on the supporter link in the episode description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your contribution.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Youssef, and here you are listening to the House Culture podcast.
House Culture.
Hello everybody, and welcome to another episode of the House Culture podcast, hosted as ever by me, Matt Rouse, the managing editor at House Culture. Thanks once again for choosing this show and letting us into your lives for the next hour or so. We put all of this together from a place of love for the club culture community, so we really do appreciate all of the support that you give us. We've also seen a huge crew of new followers to House Culture in the most recent weeks, so if it is your first time listening to the podcast, welcome to the club. We are House Culture, a collective of house music fans who have come together through their mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Instagram is our home at HouseCultureNet, so if you haven't already, grab yourself a spot on that virtual dance floor with over 100,000 other party people. And for those who want to dig deeper into what this podcast is all about, we have a massive back catalogue of episodes now featuring heavyweights from the golden era of house, like David Morales, Danny Tenaglia and Paul Oakenfold, all the way through to the new school of talent currently lighting up our dance floors like Dam Swindle, Luke Van Dyke and Purple Disco Machine. And if you want to get a behind the scenes look at this thing we call house, you can always listen to our episodes featuring the co-founder of iconic record label Strictly Rhythm, Gladys Pizarro, Pikes Hotel creative director Dawn Hindle, or the face of Clockwork Orange series of events, Danny Clockwork himself. There really is something to satisfy all tastes. So let's crack on with this one, shall we? In this episode, I sat down with a legend from Liverpool, a DJ who first gained fame from a competition win, was then tasked with bringing house music back to legendary nightclub Cream, and has now gone on to deliver a permanent legacy, not only in his own city, but in the world of house music itself. It can only be Youssef. In our chat, you'll hear how from a very young age, he was already having adventures in dance music.
We used to kind of go to like Shelley's and Stoke when we were super young, and I'd disappear for days on end and like, you know, end up in different parts of the country. I remember I went to Stoke on a night out and I ended up literally in Gloucester.
How a competition win launched his career in house music.
Bedroom Bedlam was a monthly DJ competition in Music Magazine. People would send them mixtapes every month. It was great, and they selected my tape. They did give me a gig at Ministry of Sound. So my first ever gig was to play the box at Ministry. And I was pretty nervous, but I took kind of maybe 50, 60 of my crazy friends down there.
And why his own series of parties have become such a phenomenon.
The ethos of circus has always been the same. Obviously, these days, it's more of a juggernaut. Just then, it was just an excuse for me and Rich to kind of have a party in Liverpool with our mates and get a bit wrecked and then have a party in my house, which 2 days afterwards, which was always the best bit, to be honest.
I hope you enjoy this one as much as I did. This is Youssef.
House Culture.
Hi, Youssef. It's great to have you on the House Culture podcast today. So thank you for making the time for us. You have been described as an unstoppable force in dance music, smashing your way into the scene from your own bedroom to the world stage as DJ, producer, promoter, and more recently, an activist for the nightlife community. However, before we talk about all of that, you grew up in Liverpool and you've described your childhood as tough, crazy, painful, and hilarious. Can you tell us about how you first discovered music within all of that and the kind of influence that it had on you?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, because, I grew up in a bit of a free-for-all household, shall we say, people all around all the time, and which meant there was parties and music from like a very young age. But also simultaneously what was happening was an older brother was into new romantic, like 80s synth pop, and which kind of led into early hip hop and then early acid house. And I just kind of followed his lead. And it's really interesting because he's not into music now at all. You would never know that he's probably my biggest influence.
No way.
But it was my brother, teenage brother, Tony, the oldest one, who kind of like led the path for me, really. And I got very quickly into the hip hop breakdancing scene and wanted to kind of be a breakdancer. So that's what I did. But I was so submerged into the movies and the music and the albums and the moves and everything. And I very quickly gravitated to thinking, I want to be the DJ. And that was like, that was eight.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Such a young age. So you were like in those movies and things, because this is the thing around, you know, we've spoken to a lot of, younger DJs now who are coming into the scene as well as people that have been stalwarts of the scene for a long time. And, you know, there's that difference between learning how to DJ. If you're not old enough to get into a club and you're listening to music, how did you kind of understand what a DJ was doing from that young age? What kind of media were you consuming to teach yourself?
I guess it was just watching what they were doing on turntables. You know, in like there was a movie called Breakdance the Movie, which came out like, you know, later in the 80s when I was super, super young. And I was just fascinated by the characters in the movie and then watching the DJ in the background, which happens to be Grandmaster Flash. Mm-hmm. So, and what he was doing and his adventures on turntables. And I was just interested into how this works. So that's what I used to do with my kind of the old classic with the two tape cassettes and looking at the old small violin out. But I never had any money to be able to kind of get decks, and I wasn't exactly too sure. But I guess even before I managed to get any decks, I kind of got into the acid house scene as well. And I was like, that's still what I want to do. So I was always trying to kind of find ways to get my own music by, you know, I was the type of kid that had a job from the moment I could stand as well. You know, I mean, it's crazy because my son's nearly nine. And when I was nine, I had a milk round. I had my own job, and I would go to this like dairy in like Liverpool and stand there at like 4:35 in the morning on the off chance to get like help the milkman out just to earn my own money, and then go to school, which is mental because it wasn't that long ago, But that was just kind of like I just get up in the morning, just go and then take myself to school and come back.
Wow.
But it was just that desire to kind of have self-sufficiency, be able to kind of make my own choices from a very, very young age. That's kind of led to anything that I do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then my brother took me into early raves in Liverpool and Southport and Ainsdale and anywhere in the surrounding regions, which I was way too young to go, but it was pretty loose there. Yeah. Least of your worries, what was it, like 14 or 15?
Yeah.
You know, it was like some of them were just not safe. But anyway, I didn't know who I was listening to, but I just loved the music. And I do carry that into these days because if I go to, for example, I was in Panorama Bar a couple of years ago, and I'm pretty sure I would have known the person personally who it was playing, but I just didn't want to go anywhere near the decks because I just wanted to be a raver, a clubber, and just kind of go with what's coming out the speakers. Similar when I listen to drum and bass now, I don't want to go up because I don't want to get lost into kind of, all right, mate, and then make a decision based upon it's for me, do I like it a bit more? That is from those moments in the early days where I had no idea, but does this make me feel good? That's it.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that people don't spend enough time on. They kind of decide whether it's in some sort of genre or click,
mm-hmm.
rather than like, does this music make you feel good? Yes or no? Yeah. And that's it for me.
Yeah, no, it's a great summation. I mean, you're telling a familiar tale to me. Like, I've got an older brother, age 14. I'll be going out to raves with him and doing something very similar. And it's like that you discover like a secret, and you know, suddenly all of these people are together in the dark, and they're only going to be together in that one place, that one night, as yeah. one thing. And then, you know, you all go your separate ways and you've all lived that night together. It's such an amazing feeling, like you say, to continue that and to hold that with you. It's something that I'll never forget and never lose. And I think, you know, people need to get in touch with that a lot more.
Absolutely. And, you know, for me, you know, I've always loved an adventure. It's like, you know, one of my best feelings I ever have is not knowing what's around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to know in advance. I want to just kind of have like, let's go and see what happens. And even that comes from those days, and just having I guess it was spontaneous,
yeah.
but really it was more like my situation was like lawless.
Mm-hmm.
So I can kind of just go off and wander and do what I want. And like we used to kind of go to like Shelley's and Stoke when we were super young, and mm-hmm. I'd disappear for days on end and like, you know, end up in different parts of the country. I remember I went to Stoke on a night out and I ended up literally in Gloucester. after like a 3-day kind of convoy, that's not even a figure of speech. And then sometimes we wouldn't even go out, and we would go to Knutsford services at like 4 or 5 in the morning, and all the clubbers from across the northwest would mm-hmm. kind of congregate into Knutsford services. Someone would rock up with a set of decks, and we'd just stand there all until like, you know, 10, 11 in the morning, just having it in the car park. I was only like 15, loved it.
Yeah, amazing, yeah. amazing. And so tell me about like putting together a record collection, like earning money. You've had a job since you were since you could stand, like you said. You're getting money together. Were you using that to buy music and buy records and saving up for decks? Like, how did that kind of move for you?
The deck story is like ridiculous. You know, people probably wouldn't even believe, but I'll quickly tell you. But even the money I was earning, I was using it to kind of get around, you know, just go and see my friends, be social, you know, treats and eats, really.
Yeah.
Not necessarily buying music at that stage. Actually, tell a lie. I was massively into kind of like to pop.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking back, I was a huge Madonna fan when I was thinking about it for a period. I had mm-hmm. posters all over my wall.
What era of Madonna was that? Was the Vogue era?
Yeah, it was Vogue and before.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, all those albums, which yeah. interestingly I was really into, but not into the albums after
mm-hmm.
that much. But I think it was down to they were all kind of funk based.
Yeah,
you know, maybe Nile Rodgers and Shep Pettibone, mm-hmm. People like that. And that's because it was essentially from black music.
Yeah.
And that's why I was naturally drawn to that sound, and I always have been.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's why I was a fan. It's nothing to do with the fact that you had like nudie posters in the 12 inches, which to be honest, I probably still got upstairs somewhere. But yeah, you know, but I guess I used to try and buy music as and when, but when I really got into the electronic music scene, it was to do with, you know, I wanted a set of decks so much. I really, really wanted to. Mm. Situation at home where there was no chance whatsoever of getting a set of decks. So I quickly skip over this. Basically, what happened was, one day I went to school, one of my friends, Wayne, he just goes, look, I believe you're into DJing. My dad's got a set of decks. Do you want to come and see them? They're for sale.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a brand new set of 1200s in this beautiful case, in this with mixer and a mic import and the sound. And it was in this coffin case. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, well, do you want to buy them? And I was like, yeah, I'll take it. And literally, I remember it was £600, but it may as well have been like 6 million.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a Tuesday night, and I couldn't sleep. How am I going to get this money by the morning?
Mm-hmm.
What am I going to do? Anyway, went to sleep, woke up. And when I woke up, there was a brown envelope letter. It's probably the first letter I've ever received on my doormat.
Mm-hmm.
I opened it, and it was a check for £650 for me.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened was, about a year previous, when I was doing my GCSEs, I was out having a break from revising, and me and my friend Danny were just kicking a ball in the street, and he tripped me up and went flying, or whatever happened. And anyway, yeah. I've ripped my face to shreds. If you look closely, there's a scar there.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I ripped my face to shreds. Uh-huh. And what happened was it went through legal process and all that stuff. And it was a compensation check.
No way.
Yeah.
Serendipity.
Serendipity, whatever you want to call it. The next morning, so I suddenly had this money. Mm. And the very next morning, and then, you know, it was like, wow. When I bought the decks.
Yeah.
And then practiced. I knew that, okay, this is a sign.
Yeah.
Practiced for literally 10 hours a day until I was better than anyone else in the neighborhood.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, and that's like learning to drive in a Rolls Royce, like starting off with some Technics decks.
Oh, No. I'd been going to my other friends' houses that had kind of like belt-driven decks and things like that. I'd kind of learned the basics, playing like Gabba and, you know, early acid house and hardcore and anything I can get my hands on, really. Yeah. So I'd spent like a year or so, because I went back to school, you see, to do my second year in sixth form, and they're like, look, man, it's just not for you. you're coming in and you're interested in other stuff, and just. So I had to take a year out before I went to college, and that year I went to my friend's house, Kev's, every day, and practiced on his decks, and then by chance I got my own decks out the blue, and that was that.
Incredible. And so you're honing your skills, and what were your first kind of gigs like when you started playing out, and how did you get those? Were you like handing out tapes, like banging on doors, like what was your career starter?
The full bit. When I went to college, I just made myself self-appointed entertainment manager in the students' union. I mean, I literally rocked in on the first day. I was like, look, where's the students' union? Do you need someone to run the events? And they're like, but. And I was like, I've got an idea. And then I kind of put this together and just said, this is what I can do. I'd never done it before. Mm. And then I started running events at this place called the Paradox in Liverpool for the students. It was great, actually. Worked out really well. But thinking back, the club had a really, really good deal, because I would bring like 2,000 people. And they would give me like the warm-up slot, which for like 25 quid and a crazy lager. And I was like, in. But really, it would probably make them 50 grand. Thinking about it. Anyway, but I loved it. So it was those little gigs, and, you know, just learning how to kind of play on a sound system is very different from playing in your bedroom.
Yeah.
But then obviously I started to take things a lot more seriously, and I was buying music, and I was going to college, and I was on the dole, and I was collecting money, and I was able to afford records, and then I was able to afford time to do mixtapes, and then, as you mentioned earlier, eventually I started going to Cream every week, and really honing my sound, as in, look, you know, it's black music based, which is house music, and then it led into like a little bit of techno, but really it's always anything with the funk.
Yeah.
Listen to like Derek Carter, Roger Sanchez, Carl Cox, Dave Morales.
Yeah.
You know, at Cream. And that's where I went. And then giving out those tapes at Cream to anyone that would listen, which listening back to those tapes, some of them are really specialist and some of them kind of move around sound wise. But eventually I found my groove.
Yeah.
And then I won the bedroom bedlam competition.
Yeah, this is what I want to talk about. Like, so during that year, like when you were going there as a punter, what was that club like, and that transition from the dance floor to the booth for you? Like, what was that feeling like?
Again, this is another kind of crazy moments, because I used to go to the Cream every week, and along with probably Paul Bleasdale, James Barton, who were like kind of on the other side of the fence, and I was definitely on the dance floor. I knew that club probably as well as they did. You know, I just loved it. I was obsessed.
Yeah.
I'd go four times a month, and then I'm the all-nighter. So 5 times a month I would be there.
Yeah.
You know, learning it, getting to know it and stuff. But then again, I remember when Cream had this kind of refit, and they kind of changed the booth and the sound to this amazing Steve Dash sound system, and had these floated turntables and a crossover and a rotary mixer. Bear in mind, I'm just punter.
Yeah.
Like, I'd go home and I'd be like, and I couldn't sleep sometimes worrying about how I'm gonna use those decks.
Yeah.
Even though like it was years away. Possibly, you know, they probably didn't even know I was learning how to be a DJ.
Yeah.
But then again, I had this kind of like image just in my head that one day James Barton and the other partner, Jim King, are going to stop me at this bar called the Lyceum in Liverpool on Bold Street, and they're going to ask me to be resident. I was like, I was so convinced. And then obviously things moved forward, and then I won the Bedroom Bedlam competition, and I started to get gigs at Ministry of Sound, and then Renaissance, and then Pasha in Ibiza, and all those things. And things started to kind of to take shape, and gigs started to happen. My diary was suddenly full, even though I was still working Littlewoods simultaneously on the children's underwear section, which was really weird. That's a different story. But yeah, I was an assistant buyer in the Littlewoods home shopping catalogue.
Yeah.
But then, lo and behold, there was happened to be in the Lyceum building on a Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah.
In walked James and Jim King and asked me the question.
No way. I mean, it's like you've actualized this. You've asked the universe for it and it's delivered. It's incredible.
Look, I am not spiritual in that capacity. I'm certainly not religious. And I can only go on my personal experience. And I'm certainly not like any sort of like cosmic nonsense and all that. I'm much more into hard work than sitting there and hoping for the best.
Yeah.
But there's been certain occasions on more than five times in my life where I've just kind of willed it. It literally happened that way. Yeah. I think with it, it's a tool that should be used sparingly. You know, if you're kind of thinking, okay, you know what? I wouldn't mind something this weekend, or I want to go to this place. I think, you know, don't take the piss.
Yeah.
But if you really believe in something and you feel it's going to make a positive contribution one way or another, I think it works. I don't know. I mean, like I say, I'm not into cosmic spiritual bollocks, but I can only go on my experience.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a good, it, like you say, sparingly, it's, I think, is the key. Everything in moderation, even moderation. I mean, what was there? So I want to rewind a little bit to, so obviously, you know, we've talked about the cream thing and like how that came about and, you know, the brilliant, you know, actualization of that, them asking you the question in the Lyceum. Just rewind just a little bit to the Bedroom Bedlam competition. So like for listeners who might not, it was a monthly competition, wasn't it? It was a music magazine. And just take us through that.
Like, okay, Bedroom Bedlam was a monthly DJ competition in music magazine, and music magazine was at the time it was at least rubbing shoulders with Mixmag for kind of readership around the world, and obviously it was physical copies. Now they used to have this competition where people would send them mixtapes every month, and it would literally get thousands all over the world. And other winners are Marcus James from Renaissance, obviously famously James Abila. But I think I was the first one that kind of was the pinup of it, I guess, really, because the mix was, even to this day, it's on my SoundCloud if you want to listen to it. It's still great. It's raw.
I've listened to it a few times over the years and I had a flick through it this morning. It's still great.
Yeah, it is. And I remember doing it in my bedroom, thinking, okay, this is all right, this one. And obviously all I had was, at the time, two decks, a little play and record, like hi-fi stereo. Just got on with it on a crappy mixer, but it came out really well. But from, I won that, and it was Felix and Basement Jacks and Lottie that selected the mix, and Ben Turner, who was the editor at the time. He's gone on to do all sorts, like IMS, for example, Richie Horn's manager. He's done lots and lots. He's contributed to the scene, like a few others, but he picked it as well. So it was great, and they selected my tape, and I was very happy. I remember working in Littlewoods in my little desk, thinking, oh, shit, look at this. Wow, this is kind of cool. And as always, I'm very cautious not to think, okay, I've won the lottery, let's go. I was like, all right, let's just take it easy.
Yeah.
But they did give me a gig at Ministry of Sound. So my first ever gig was to play the booth in the box at Ministry.
Yeah.
My first gig. And I was pretty nervous, but I took kind of maybe 50, 60 of my crazy friends down there. So it was like a semi-full dance floor from the off. So it was all right. And they were really happy. And they eventually were like, okay, we'll give you another gig. We'll see how it goes, playing cool. And that was all right. But what happened to change everything was I got a gig at Pasha in Ibiza as part of the Bedroom Bedlam win.
Yeah.
And it was from Renaissance with Satoshi Tomai and Lord G, who was like massive at the time. He was like the hot person. And it was great, and DJ Pippi, legendary Pippi, was playing before me.
Yeah.
So I went in the booth and I was ready and I'd done a warm-up set at Bar M, the Manumission Bar. Mm-hmm. Then I headed down to Pasha with my mates and it was obviously all vinyl mm-hmm. at the time. And I just thought people play like this as standard. So I just went in the booth, assumed, obviously never really done, it was easily the biggest gig I'd ever done in my life by a long, long way at that point. And I just started and was playing like kind of like tech funk, like roulet sounding tunes and kind of more Latin and just a real range of kind of good energy, proper house music, but the way I'm mixing is on three decks and cutting this and beats and acapellas. And mm-hmm. there was just one particular moment when I had two copies of this track by Roy Davis Jr. called Rock Shock mm-hmm. on Roulet. And what I used to do, and it's a classic, actually it was Roger Sanchez that taught me this. He probably doesn't even know. I used to watch him doing it. And it was like double beat, you know, you have half a beat behind, so it goes, and you create your own crescendo. Mm-hmm. And I was just doing that. And then I had like another track on a third deck, and it was just going nuts, and the room was going off. And then I come off out the booth thinking, well, I'm all right. And it was like 10 agents happened to be there. And I was going, come on, and all those things.
Yeah.
No sign for me, sign for that. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
So Ben Turner kind of took me to one side and goes, look, you're going to get a lot of attention now. Be cool, go and have a good night, and we'll speak on Monday.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, so that's exactly what I did. Monday morning, a phone call comes from this lady called Amy Thompson, mm-hmm. who was the booker for Ministry of Sound, and she had a roster with Danny Tsnigular on, and Todd Terry, and Dave Morales, and mm-hmm. it's like the best roster in the country.
Yeah.
She wanted to be on it. And it was the Ministry of Sound roster. Let me think. Could take like half a second. So they signed me to the roster, and eventually Amy left and went to set up her own thing called Cement, and I went over there. Mm-hmm. So I went from kind of a DJ gig at Pasha in Ibiza to being on easily the best roster in the UK, and then a pretty full diary within a few weeks. I mean, the Bedroom Bedlam thing was in December. Mm-hmm. This happened in July. And then I was kind of getting to go by the September. So it was like 10 months from the win to move. And then I didn't want to leave Littlewoods even still. I was going to gigs the weekend, you know, going to Austria, doing all these things, coming back Monday morning. Mm-hmm. People would say, how was your weekend? And I'd go, well, it's all right. How was yours? And then mow the lawn. You know, so sadly, even though I got promotion in work in Littlewoods, I got there was something along the lines of a recruitment ban or something, mm-hmm. and it meant that I couldn't take the promotion, which meant I got made redundant.
Oh, what? No so, way.
I know. So it was like, shit. Okay, yeah. Well, maybe this is the nudge. Mm. And I've never looked back.
Yeah, yeah.
Interestingly, though, even better than that was because I was a size 34 waist and a size 8 shoe and a size 42 chest, and it was in the Littlewoods catalogue. They used to hire me to come in to be kind of like a clothes horse, not a model, just to stand there and go, okay, does this fit and all, and put pins in it and stuff. To get paid to do that was more than my wages.
No way.
So I was only coming in for like 2 hours a week. I get paid more than I was getting for doing a full 38 hours. It's like every cloud.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's your promotion.
And then the gigs kicked in, and mm-hmm. And I've been pro DJ ever since. So that bit was okay. But like you say, the nudge, because of my situations growing up, I'm like, okay, this is a steady paycheck here.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't leave even until, you know, it's impossible. And obviously that decision was made for me.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and you've never looked back since. I mean, to go from, like you say, within a year, having that full calendar and full diary, playing mm-hmm. all these gigs across the world and Europe and whatever, you know, you were looking at those decks in Cream and you were so worried about getting behind them and the rotary mixer and the floating decks and all that kind of stuff. What was that first gig like there for you? Was it as good as you hoped? Because sometimes, and we've spoken to quite a lot of people, and they think that this gig is going to be the one, this is going to be my favourite ever one, and one that I'll always remember and never forget. And then they go and something goes wrong, or it's not 100% perfect, and it can sometimes be built up too much. I mean, how was it for you?
I flattened the place because I really did. I got so much local support. support. And it was in a local paper, and I guess there's no such before social media, so you know, there was a good buzz on it. And everybody came out to see me, and the room was full, and I played start to finish. I played 6 hours.
Wow.
So, yeah. So that was the setup. That was what Cream wanted. They're like, look, we want you to come and basically bring house music back to Cream, which what it was built upon.
Yeah.
Okay. So I played 6 hours, and people had made banners, and it was cool with the decks, and I was playing completely new music what other people were not. Yeah. You know, I was breaking music into the UK that nobody else had.
Mm-hmm.
Because what was happening simultaneously as well was, for some reason, because Cream was like 2 years into the nonsense.
Yeah.
But simultaneously, Amy, who's my manager as well as agent, had got me a slot on Radio 1.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd gone from never doing radio before to folding children's underwear to literally doing a slot on Radio 1 and playing this new music.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'd built up, like, I'd gone to Miami, sort of went to music conference and made loads of friends, I was like, look, I'm just going to just go. I don't know how it's going to work out. And when I arrived, all the kind of like West Coast DJs and the New Yorkers, like Onions and Joski and Doc Martin and Halo and Hippie and all those guys were like, and they gave me all these kind of dub plates and acetates and test pressings of all this kind of music that was not going to be out for like 18 months, 2 years.
Yeah.
And I had all, just because I played a few bits on Radio 1, or, you know, I was getting behind it or emailing or just kind of trying to get to know them. So, yeah, I started inviting those guys to come play in the Annex with me and Cream, and giving people like Halo and Hippie the first UK gig, and certainly Onions and Joski, and just started to kind of rebuild the sound of house, which went really well. And the thing at the Annex went really well. And I think that's when Mixmag were like, okay, what was happening was at Music Mag, I'd been given a column with Carl Cox was the champ and I was the contender. So every month, they would call me and say, what you've been up to? And I would just tell them all these like stupid things I've been doing, and after parties. And I mean, I'd literally tell them what I've been up to. you know, whereas if you read Carl's, he's like, oh, I've been playing a movement, I've been with Jeff Mills, we've been talking about this new kind of live show we're going to do. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, we can get off my head, we made somewhere in a gym costume. It's really, really funny, you know, as in like the contrast, but I think that's what they liked. But the point of what was happening was it made my profile grow and grow and grow and grow.
Yeah.
And then the Radio 1 thing, and then the bringing the music in, and all these record shops up and down the country were like, where'd you get these tunes from? And then Mixmag were like, okay, we have to give them some attention now.
Yeah.
So what they did, they were like, do you want to do a cover month CD? And this is 2001, it's called The Winter Warmer.
Yeah.
Like, okay. So again, they said, just do what you want. And I'd set up my three decks at home, press play and record. And I just did this mix. And even to this day, it's one of the best mixes I've ever done. I hear music in colour, you see. You see things in colour.
Yeah.
The synesthesia. Mm-hmm. So just the colours in that mix from start to finish. And just the skill level on it in terms of kind of having 2-3 copies of things. If you really try to dissect that mix, it's much more complicated than people realise.
Mm-hmm.
And I was given like new like H Foundation remixes, which nobody had, from Soma and these Derek Carter bits, and new Master Dean on Onions and Joski, which nobody had, from NRK and Ian Pooley, all these things.
Mm-hmm.
Performed just one mix and give it to Mixmag, and it blew up.
Yeah.
Went absolutely, I mean, it would be the equivalent of viral now.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had a copy. It was, you couldn't go to an after party anywhere in the UK without someone banging this mix on. And it became a thing. And I had all these like record shops up and down the country phoning me saying, where can I get hold of these tunes? So I was getting them in touch with Syntax in New York to say, these are the distributors.
Yeah.
So the West Coast guys, Onions and Joski and all those guys were like, thank you, you know, and it was getting, things were kind of growing and growing and growing.
Mm.
For me, I was just DJing, being nice, being helpful, playing new tunes.
Yeah.
And that's it. And isn't that the point? Yeah. So things started to really, really cook from that.
Yeah, and you know, and during that era as well, that vinyl era, it was about, you would go and see specific DJs to hear them play tunes that only they had. It was like a real badge of honor at that point to be able to have these, you know, secretive acetates that no one else has got. And it's like, oh, I saw, you know, so-and-so play in this club and they played this track. No one else has got it. You know, if you want to hear that again, you've got to go and follow that DJ. That's exactly. You know, do you think that's kind of changed in the digital era a little bit, do you still keep hold of special things just for you?
Well, a bit of both, because I like to make sure the music is out there being listened to.
Yeah.
But it's good to have kind of your own specials here and there. I've got lots of my own versions of my own tracks, for example, mm-hmm. or things which may or may never come out. But it's a double-edged sword, because moving the music forward, which for me is always the most important part, having digitalized everything, it gives it the opportunity to get music kind of made today, played tonight. Mm-hmm. And that's great, because I do think, for the most part, even though it's easy to make music now and distribute it a lot quicker, generally the music is a lot better and it's a lot more accomplished.
Yeah.
Does it have the vibe? Who knows? But I think the amount of music being released during the week, every week, is phenomenal.
Mm.
But the amount of effort and time and skill level compared to the producers, say then, 2001, compared to now, it's night and day. People are a lot more accomplished. Your average producer is probably a lot more accomplished than those guys then.
Yeah.
But have they got the spirit of the music correct?
Mm-hmm.
And that overall, especially with so many years in the game now, that's the bit which I think is really important. You know, especially as a label owner, or is that like A&R for myself? Finding the spirit and something I think makes you go, ooh, that's the trick. And it can be technically perfect. Is fine and great, but you know,
it's all like, if something's too perfect or too like shiny, it can sometimes, like you say, sometimes it needs a bit of grime, it needs to be rolled in the mud a little bit sometimes, and you know, have that slapdash attitude to feel like it has a bit of spirit, like you say. I mean, so we kind of sidetracked there a little bit. You know, we're talking about 2002 and that kind of era, and that was when, you know, you set up Circus as a club night. I mean, what was your ethos in kind of setting that up, and what did you want to achieve with it?
Well, basically, obviously, I was still doing the 6-hour sets at Cream, and I was bringing all these people through for the first time to the UK, and the Annex was rocking. For the most part, sometimes it wouldn't work, and it was because there in the Annex was say, like, you know, super underground, fresh, but then in the other room at Cream, it was like candy, kind of hard house trance.
Yeah.
And it was two completely different things.
Yeah.
So I was on Radio 1, and then there's candy hard house trance. Then people are like, well, you know, is that what he does?
Mm.
The reality is, I'm over here pumping the underground and breaking new music in the UK for the first time and pushing it. But people didn't, it was kind of mixed messages.
Yeah.
As such. So I said to Cream, look, even though I don't want to, one of two things is going to happen. I either move on or I start my own night. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, let's just start your own night. We'll get right behind you, come up with the concept. And I was like, okay, so this was in Miami, the Shore Club Hotel, just having a, you know, couple of cocktails, me and James Barton and Amy, and that's what we decided to do. And then, so we set it all up. And then I went to a party that night in Miami, and it was chaos.
Mm.
It was in this penthouse, and there was all these people there, all these like DJs and aficionados, and everyone was wrecked and it was going nuts, and people were trying to get in, and it was like, whoa. And it was just like a circus. It's crazy. I was like, this is it.
Yeah.
I was DJing and it was going nuts, and it was brilliant. So I was like, okay, we'll call it circus. That was cool. And then we came back, and we spent months setting it all up and preparing for it and all those things. Had the artwork done, I designed the logo myself, had it all prepared, and then sadly Cream shut.
Yeah.
Yeah, they opted, or the company that had bought them opted to concentrate on Creamfields for the time being, which obviously was a great idea in hindsight.
Yeah.
And so I was left without an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Step in my friend, who I'd met at Cream. So I got a phone call. It was on the first holiday I'd had in like years and years and years and years as well. And I got a phone call from my mate Rich, and he just goes, you know, what's the story like? You know, you've got a good following in Liverpool. I've got access to this venue. Do you want to just do circus with me? And I was like, yeah, man. So I spoke to Cream, said it's okay. They take the logo, it's my logo. And like, yeah, just do what you want. He designed it. And then we decided to start circus on a smaller scale at the Arts Club, The Mask, in the theatre with Richard McGuinness, who was my mate at the time. He was the first person to book me for a gig where I had to get on a plane. He took me to his place in Northern Ireland. But we were already mates, hanging out, party boys. So we started circus together. And I said, look, I'll fund it. Or do you want to go halves? And he's like, well, what is it? And I said, well, let's just put £500 in each. So that's what we did. We've been 50-50 ever since. And, you know, he's like beyond brother. And so we started and we went to the Mask, as it was called, which is like an old amphitheater. We literally took out the rest of the seats, did a little bit of production, put a bit of a sound system in. Scrappy as you can possibly be, four or five people showed up and it was rocking. And it was absolutely brilliant. And yeah, when we haven't stopped.
I mean, you know, it's been running so long, and you must have seen so many changes in terms of club culture, the music, the technology, you know, the crowds and everything. You know, how have you kept yourself fresh and interested through those changes? You know, it's often people can want to relive the past and want to keep it like, oh, I want to keep it that way. That's when I had the most enjoyment, and rail against kind of things changing. Like, how have you kept it fresh for yourself during this period?
Well, I think the one thing we've done is, even though it's my night and I'm the face of it and all those things, I'm not the headliner. You know, as in, so it's not like, if you look at a lot of other DJ nights, generally it's kind of no matter what, and then like names underneath. And I understand that if you are the main ticket seller, essentially. And to run the business, I've always kind of been, the reality is, kind of in the middle. You know, not the kind of warm-up guy by any stretch of the imagination. Able to, you know, kick it with any DJ in the world, there's no doubt about that. But in terms of like bums on seats, there are bigger names. So the circus lineup, circus nights, have always been about kind of unmissable lineups. So because I've been comfortable with being amongst the lineup, I think that naturally leans to bringing in new names every single month. So whether it be kind of the formula was simple, as a DJ, big name, me, new name, and a couple of, when we used to have like a three-room venue, you know, breaking people, like, you know, Loco Dice's first UK gig. Like Jamie Jones used to be the third room DJ for us, £200. Seth Troxler, people like this that had never played in the UK. Even early enough, Phil Weeks. You had to all those guys bringing them into the UK for the first time. But at the same time, Carl Cox, Laurent Garnier, you know, people like that. And the formula over time has kind of, I guess it's worked. Even though we're just a one room venue now, but it's kind of still, the levels we go to make, we do our best to make the kind of customer experience these days safe and fun and excellent. The ethos of circus has always been the same. You know, it's like entertainment and enlightenment. And that means having a great time, listening to new music. Obviously, these days, it's more of a juggernaut, if you would like. Just then, it was just an excuse for me and Rich to kind of have a party in Liverpool with our mates and get a bit wrecked, and then have a party in my house afterwards, for 2 days afterwards, which was always the best bit, to be honest. But like, you know, DJing in a theatre, though, I have to say, it's one of the best rooms anywhere in the world. When it connects, because it's on the steps, it goes up, it's like a tsunami of like energy. It goes out when it goes off. And I've had some incredible nights there. You know, obviously the 500th Essential Mix was unbelievable.
I mean, and what was that like? Like getting that call? Obviously, the Essential Mix is, you know, an iconic institution in our community. To get that milestone under your name, was that quite special?
Yeah, I mean, because we talked about booking Pete for ages, because at the time we'd be like super, like, you know, house, you know, and all those things, and maybe move around a little bit. We didn't know where Pete sat, but he was a friend, he was supportive. I always placed my tunes on Radio One. I was like, look, man, you know, he's a legend in the city as well. It's time. Mm-hmm. So we booked Pete, and just by chance, he's like, look, the 500th Essential Mix is coming up. Bear in mind, he could, like you say, he could have done it anywhere, mm-hmm. any club in the world, and it would have been an instant yes, because it was like a live broadcast. And we were like, whoa, really? And they're like, he was okay, yeah, this week we're going to do it with you, because there was so much heat on Circus. We'd already won BBC Club of the Year, mm-hmm. and a few other accolades and things. It was like, okay, this is what I want to do. Great, fantastic. So we set it all up, went to kind of the biggest names in the industry. We've been trying to get Richie Horton for years, mm-hmm. but we couldn't quite get him, because obviously it's a small venue and economics and all that.
Yeah.
But he was down with doing the 500 Essential Mix. He was Pete. And then there was Sasha, mm-hmm. and then there was the online vote for Aeroplane, mm-hmm. which is the irony that the Aeroplane were with the online vote, because the same week, the days leading up to it, was that massive ash cloud.
Oh, right. Brooklyn. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I'm not even joking here. At 10 o'clock in the morning on the day of the gig, bear in mind the BBC had been in the Liverpool all week, putting in these ISDN computer lines and making sure the broadcast is live and all these things, and we set the venue. 10 o'clock in the morning, we had no lineup. Nobody was in the country at all. And it's like, maybe 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And I was like, on the one hand, shit. But on the other hand, yeah, I'm going to do a 5-hour Essential Mix. So I was kind of like,
opportunity knocks.
Yeah, so we'll see how it goes. And honestly, nobody was coming in. Mm. And just by chance, it got to about 5 o'clock, and we got a call. Pete's got a boat from Calais, so he came over, and then someone else got a boat from like Rotterdam or something, mm-hmm. and someone else managed to get like a private jet via the other way into South Wales, and we got up by the skin of our teeth, which is a phrase that makes no sense, by the way. But the skin of our teeth, just as we were opening, everybody got in the country, and we just cracked on as if nothing had happened. And yeah, so,
meant to be.
And the excitement and the tension, and it was incredible. We went to shut at 4. Richie Horton still banging the tunes out 4:15. It's on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah.
He loved it. Everybody did. It was absolutely incredible.
Iconic. That gig
was one of the greats.
Excellent, excellent.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
And, you know, I want to talk about as well. Obviously, you're not only a DJ, you're not only, you know, owner of one of the best club nights out there. You know, it's you're also a producer in your own right, and you've done some albums over the years. And, you know, I just want to talk to you about when you're sitting down to create something, and an album in dance music is often difficult to kind of pull off, really, you know, to create something like that. Often it could be just a collection of singles or whatever. Like, when you're sitting down to create something like that in the studio, do you have like a theme, and what inspires you, and how do you kind of get to what you want to put out?
Well, I think to my detriment in some ways, when I do an album, I want to make it an album, you know, and people are like, oh, I thought you were a DJ and a, you know, producer, label owner. What's the story? And I'm like, I'm also a person with like a story to tell, you know? So I think certainly when I did Project of Your Environment, I'd sat down in a proper studio for literally months, writing songs, bringing in musicians, you know, and it was originally meant to be in 7D surround sound as well. And that's a whole different story, which took me down to working with Dolby on the Atmos project, which was the first person to do that as well. So we did that, and it was just kind of like telling stories and just trying to get off my chest what I had to say at that time as a kind of artist rather than just a producer. And more recently with my last album, about three years ago, Nine More Drive, was designed to be a complete cathartic project. I was driving through Crosby, where I used to live, and we went past my old street, and I said, I used to live down there. So I went down, and as soon as I seen the house, I was like, whoa, and all these kind of like heavy memories back, and I realized, you know, that this is shit I'm still carrying around here. You know, so I went off and I decided at that moment that I'm gonna write an album about the times and tribulations and difficulties in that place. So I did. So I got to work and started, and I wrote maybe 20 stories to myself, like small synopsis of like situations, and then pulled them out and then started making music and writing lyrics and things around those particular stories. Not just making a banger, that's all right, isn't it? Bit of a sample. Not at all, the total opposite. Bringing in like musicians and thinking, okay, I want this to have strings. I need a kind of like a sax in this part, or, you know, the whole album was completely sample free, actually. That Nine More Drive one. But yeah, it was a deep, heavy, painful, but massively cathartic process. Which took me ages, cost me loads. That was like, I'm never going to recoup on it. But you know what? In terms of deciding to do something, carrying it through until kind of the blood, through the blood, sweat, and tears into kind of a tangible physical project. I love that shit. I love being able to kind of say, I'm going to do something and then do it. And then to get an amazing amount of kind of support from my peers was cool. You know, I got what's it called, hottest record in the world from Annie Mack, and it was massively well received. In terms of as far as it goes these days. But you know, I am very proud of that Nine More Drive project because it was so difficult. And it did release a lot of pain off my shoulders, really, and it put a line in the sand, and it turned what was very, very difficult to kind of get my kind of absorb historical difficulties into something that was positive and tangible and over.
And to be able to put that out there and then, like you say, draw that line and move on from it.
I guess so, though, in the Nine More Drive project, I did make it more floor friendly in the end. You know, particularly there's one track called I Don't Understand, which is like gnarly, synthy, still funk based, but like it's more like techno than house. But I made this amazing video for it. Have you seen the video that was doing the rounds a couple of years ago? It was it's intense, and you know, and it's not fun. it's emotional, you know. And obviously, I guess when you are on the fringes or your entry level like club culture, it's just fun. It's meant to be a laugh, and I completely agree with that. But I think sometimes if you do something that's a bit more challenging, maybe it's not for everyone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it is an incredible album, and you know, it certainly got the reaction, and like you say, Annie Mac recognised it as well. And I think, you know, I think it's a brilliant piece of work. And like I have read, you know, in the prep for this piece as well, you know, you talking about each individual track and kind of how you put that together, and it is, you know, if people dig into that, it is so interesting, and you know, it's so much more meaningful about music. Yeah. It's a great journey that you've been on. I do really want to talk about, you know, your kind of, during the pandemic era, about you becoming a figurehead, activist style, you know, whatever you want to call it, for, you know, being that voice out there for supporting nightlife and club culture during, you know, those COVID years. I mean, you know, were you surprised at what that brought out in yourself? I mean, that you became this person, and what was there a moment that gave you the calling to become, you know, this adopted spokesperson?
Well, yeah, I guess I'm just like sitting over there on the chair, and like, you know, obviously COVID had kicked in and all that stuff, and I was like, at first I didn't have lots of money in the bank. I was like, you know, I've got a year and a half here, I'll be all right. But then I realized quite quickly, most of the people I know, particularly people that work at the events and the record labels and the surrounding things, haven't got anything. They work gig to gig to gig to gig to gig. And I was like, oh, shit, well, that's not cool. Mm-hmm. You know, surely there's got to be something that we can do. So I put out this post on Instagram. And I just was sitting over there. Okay, that's it. I'm going to use my time, my energy, my contacts, my abilities, whatever I've got, to help, you know, to see if we can kind of, this is a call to action. I don't know where I'm heading with this, but I'm going to give it a go. Mm-hmm. And I said something like, troops assemble. And it was something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And it went nuts. You know, and everyone was like, okay, we're going to get behind you, all those things. And people, there was like thousands of comments and all those things. And it was quite exciting. So I started to hear from the NTIA, the Nightimer Industries Association, and you know, I speak to Michael Kill, and that was the very beginnings of it. Mm. But then, strangely, extremely strangely, within 2 weeks of that post, it was 2 weeks of the day, I got this phone call from this guy, and I was like, hello, this is that you, sir? I was like, yeah, and he goes, this is the Lord Lieutenant of Liverpool. And I was like,
what is that?
Excuse my ignorance, but my... fuck, is a Lord Lieutenant? And it turns out the Lord Lieutenant, there's one in every major city, and they represent the royal family.
Right, okay.
So the royal family, as in especially Prince William, kind of got hold of me and wanted to have a discussion about what was going down in Liverpool. Because what had happened at the time was Liverpool had been put into Tier 4 ahead of anyone else in the country. Mm-hmm. And that meant the hospitality industry in the city was completely decimated. And there's me kind of shouting the odds, speaking to the local council, saying that, you know, we need some more support, and there's going on BBC News already. And, you know, at the very beginnings of this kind of thing, and he wanted a discussion to see what was going on. And it was not allowed to be like broadcast. And it was meant to be like, I thought it was 5-10 minutes. Mm. So we set it up and just in that room in there. And it was like 45-minute, nearly 50-minute conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think the best way to describe it was, actually, the one thing I said at the beginning of the conversation was, look, what's a story, you know, about how to address him, you know, speaking to his PA, and like, do we call him, like, look, just call him William, it's cool.
Yeah.
The only thing you have to do is just give it to him. Don't kind of think, you know, have to kind of hold back, or, you know, hold your P's and Q's. He's not asked. He just wants to hear what's going on. So myself and another business owner, Natalie, who runs a place called Leaf on Bold Street in Liverpool, both of us were invited for this conversation in the end. And we just give it to him.
Yeah.
Explain what was going on and how much our industry had been decimated locally and then nationally. And we give our views and say, can you take some of this to Parliament? And he did.
Yeah.
You know, so we had this like conversation, and obviously the next day that went nuts, and when it was on BBC News, or it was all over the world and national, international news. Yeah. It's like, okay, shit. So at that point, because of the profile rise, I started getting invited to these like government round tables, which are all like Zoom calls like this, where I would give my advice and other people from our industry would be on them. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to drum up a bit of support with the other DJs in the community and on a WhatsApp group. But I think I was persistent And like, I wanted to kind of really like see this through and see where we could go. But then I started started to talk to Liverpool Council saying, look, surely at some point there's got to be some sort of exit strategy for the events industry, because you know, there's so many people. Turns out there's 750,000 people in our industry nationwide that have been left with literally nothing because everyone else is on furlough or all these things, they've been supported. Yeah. But we were not. And it was awful. So simultaneously, we were trying to kind of find ways to be supported. And I was asking Liverpool Council, my business partner, look, we have a venue, Bramley Moor Dock. We have an amazing company called Tech UK that can do all the production, who we use. It's open for COVID in terms of like, it's not covered. It's kind of half indoor, half outdoor.
Yeah.
Is any chance we can have like an event? And I'm like, oh no, there's just no chance. Forget it. And this was like months before it happened.
Yeah.
Then eventually, after this was before Christmas or something, but then the R rate settled down to one, mm-hmm. and that means basically you're able to kind of trigger the opportunity to do test events. So because Liverpool did so amazingly well with the mass testing, it was the first in the UK to have mass testing implemented in the city. And then we were shouting the odds and we had the venue and Liverpool being given the nod by the government to do test events. They were like, okay, let's give Youssef and Richard a shout and see if they're up for it. And we were like, okay. And as always with everything that we've always done, it's always a we'll figure it out later. we were given 3 weeks' notice to put on these test events at our own expense as well. It wasn't government; it was government sanctioned, but not. So myself, Richard, the folks from Liverpool Council, Matt from the Health and Safety, Ian Bookham from Liverpool University. Yeah, so there was all sorts of professors and there's people from down the country and the government and on these calls every single day leading up to the event to try and learn and understand how we're going to be able to get thousands of people tested ahead of these events and make them safe and how can we pull on the data that's required to be able to see if we can get beyond COVID. And it was complicated beyond words. I can't over-exaggerate how difficult it was for everyone to kind of get today's page of rules ticked off, because tomorrow they're going to be different, and then tomorrow we're going to be different, and then tomorrow after that we're going to be different. And that's the way it went. So we just started booking DJs, trying to kind of figure out how we sell tickets. Oh, by the way, you've got to use this government app. We're like, but we use Skiddle, but you can't use Skiddle because they're this. And we're like, well, this is going to be a disaster.
Yeah.
And all these kind of like difficulties we had to kind of deal with. And it was absolutely, simultaneously, you wouldn't believe how much shit I was getting online as well.
Really?
Oh, you wouldn't believe it.
What kind of shit? Just what the fact that you were putting on an event?
Anti-vaxxers, kind of. You know, people saying I'm in with the government.
Oh my god!
All these things. I mean, worst of all was, I mean, like I say, give me shit. Call me whatever you want. By all means, be racist if you want. Just don't call me a Tory. You know, and that's what we've been saying, because they've been saying it was government sanctioned. But I was like, look, I'm working with Liverpool Council, you know, and all these things. But look, we tried so hard, and we managed with the full squad to pull it off.
Yeah.
And it was magical beyond words.
I mean, when the videos of that came online, that event, and it was like a warm ray of sunshine, like a tonic, like this is happening. This is happening now, you know, this is back. It was hair raising to see the atmosphere in that event when it happened. I mean, was it as good as it looked?
It was much better.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never played a better gig ever. You know, every single person in there knew the significance of what we were trying to achieve. Every single person in there, as soon as they walked through the door, left COVID behind for a day. Yeah. So just the relief on the shoulders just to be themselves. Yeah. So that moment when I played Free by Ultimate Nate, and I had this big build up with my track, when we would be free again and all these things. And it was so powerful.
Yeah.
You know, everyone on stage was like literally in tears, and people were on the floor out pogoing and pounding the floor, and it was beyond words. I've never seen anything like it, because it meant so much to so many people to just be out. But yeah, big up to all the DJs for coming along and trying to take part. And you know, obviously we paid everyone, but everyone did it for a reduced rate because of costs and all these things. And it was magic. It's absolutely unbelievable. You know, like I say, everyone that I've mentioned, the Liverpool Council, Matt from Health and Safety, Ian Buchan, Richard McGuinness, Sam Newsom from our production company, Eddie, our health and safety guy, everyone first class.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And on top of that, all the ravers for going through the lengths that seemed like they were completely alien, which became normalized for a short period of time, getting a test before you go into the club and all that.
Yeah.
Then it was the first place to do it, like anywhere, like literally anywhere. So it was a big moment, and it wasn't just the UK that was watching; it was every single major news network anywhere around the world. We're like, okay, let's see what can be done.
Yeah,
You know, it was on CNN, Bloomberg, Australian TV, anywhere. You know, I must have done like 150 interviews leading up to it, as well as trying to. Let's just say I was having a personal circumstance change simultaneously, but that's a different story. So complicated. But what was one of the take homes from it, even though it was really successful, and you know, it got, I think, eight billion interactions online in the end, which is mental. It was something like that. There's this place in Liverpool called the Spine Building, and it's like a new like educational facility essentially near the educational district in Liverpool. Now, because of the aforementioned efforts, when myself and Richard and everyone went to, they invited me to come and speak and basically tell this story on this panel one morning when they were opening the building, like a few months after. Okay, so I'll come along. And there was all the professors that I mentioned, and everyone was kind of really scripted and you know, this is how it went, and everything was really factual. They got to me at the end, and I just stood up and just gave the whole story, and it was really refreshing because it was so natural and kind of, you know, and they loved it. But then I got stopped by this guy called Daniel Elliott, who's at the other end of the room, and he goes, okay, my name's Daniel, I'm from Innova, and I'm from the company that set up every single COVID test in the UK. I own the pharma company.
Right.
He goes, I was so blown away by watching what you guys did. He was watching it in his home in LA or something. And he seen what was happening. And it's like, okay, something's got to change here. So he got up, spoke to his partners in Innova, and immediately donated £10 million to the Spine Building in the UK. So Daniel Elliott, he donated £10 million to the Spine Building on this, after seeing basically me on TV on CNN, to the National Pandemic Institute.
Right.
So he set up the National Pandemic Institute in Liverpool. So anywhere in the country, that's where it is because of what happened on that day. And when I was there having that conversation with him, he goes, look, I'm going to donate another £10 million to make sure that this is sustained.
Wow.
So because of the efforts that we all went to that day for the first dance, we've now got a National Pandemic Institute in Liverpool because of it.
That is mind-blowing.
Mind-blowing. So all that, if you look at the top of this conversation, you know, dicking around in Liverpool with your mates, the arc is to that moment, which is literally going to help people live for, you know, X amount of years until it's funded and funded and funded again.
Yeah.
It's mental.
It is. And like, how do you square that with yourself? Is it just hilarious, or is it mind blowing, or is it like it makes you feel proud, or you just can't believe it?
A little bit of everything. I think that my main take out of life in general is I just want people to be happy. You know, and I think everything that I've done hopefully leads to that moment, you know, and if this is going to help people, like you say, I have to make it really clear, my contribution is not, it's not all about me, the reason is the National Pandemic Institute, but I contributed in some small way.
Yeah.
And for me, that's just incredible. That is going to be something so significant in my city. Yeah. I contributed to in a small way, and it's absolutely brilliant.
That is brilliant. It's perfect. It's perfect. Cool. All right. So we're at the point in the interview where we want to talk about the perfect playlist. So this is the perfect playlist on Spotify. You can search it up, House Culture Perfect Playlist. Every single one of our podcast guests has contributed 5 tracks based on the different themes that we have. The playlist itself, it's over like 30 hours long or something like that. It's a huge beast. It's got loads of random stuff in there, loads of anthems, loads of brilliant music. Just put it on shuffle. It's incredible. And you've been great in giving me your choices. And what we want to do is just kind of briefly go through kind of each one, talking about the theme and why that choice of track just kind of popped into your head to answer that question. So are you, I can read out your choices to you.
Okay, great.
If that's cool, if that works. So we always ask for a catalyst, a track that got you into dance music, and you've chosen something from Strictly Rhythm. And we have spoken to Gladys Pizarro, who co-founder of Strictly Rhythm, on this podcast as well, and that's like a really interesting listen. You've chosen Photon Inc. Generate Power, the Wild Pitch mix of that. Why have you chosen that tune?
Well, for me, that is the blueprint of house music. Mm-hmm. You know, as in the way it starts, the bass, the layers after layers after layers. And it's got like a journey element to it, and it's dirty, and it's got the funk and energy, and it lifts and lifts and lifts. And for me, that's how house music should be. It's a groove, mm-hmm. and it's almost kind of progressive before progressive. Mm-hmm. It's not kind of like cinematic progressive. Yeah. What I mean is the music is moving forward constantly, and it's so raw and exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for me, it's literally one of the best pieces of house music ever made.
Yeah, it's from where it starts, like you say, every moment there's something being added and added. And if you skip from the beginning to the end, you're like, how did it get from here to there?
Yeah. I guess it summarizes this podcast.
Well, indeed, yeah. Cool. All right. So a floor filler. You've chosen a floor plan, Never Grow Old. Why have you chosen that as a floor filler? What's your experience with that tune?
Well, you know what I love about it is because I guess, like, obviously M-Plant is a super underground label, and I guess Floor Plan are super underground artists. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, really. But that tune, it cuts through everybody. You know, you can probably play that in a bar in a full city centre and everybody would go nuts. Mm-hmm. Or you can play a Time Warp. And I think because, again, it's exciting, it's colourful, it's got a fat kick. And like I say, it's multi-generational as well. And it's, you know, it's only like, you know, what is it, 8, 9, 10 years old now, maybe. Mm-hmm. And it just never fails. I don't play it often. But if it was going to play something that I feel is going to nail it, that's the one.
Yeah. Brilliant choice.
And also it's an anthem, but not, it still stays on, you know, underground.
Yeah I know what you mean. Like, that's the best type. It's, yeah. So your sunsetter, you've chosen Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd. Why have you chosen that one?
Well, Pink Floyd's a band that I've been with since I was a kid. I used to have to listen to music before bed every night. Mm-hmm. And I'd listen to Dark Side of the Moon like regularly. Mm-hmm. And all Pink Floyd's music. And I guess this is one track that stayed with me. A few times I played the Sunset set at Mambo, mm-hmm. Which is rare these days. People just bang out there now often. But then when I was living in Ibiza, I said, can I come and, you know, do the Sunset so it's done the way it should be done? Yeah. And that was just one of the tunes that I played, and I was playing for like an hour and a half, and it's just beautiful watching the music go. It's suddenly the sun go into the sea as the music's playing, and it's just it's 42 years old. That track, 43 years old.
Yeah,
unbelievable piece of music. And for me, interestingly, with Pink Floyd reformed one gig for Live 8, mm-hmm. I'd been a Pink Floyd fan my whole life, mm-hmm. and until I seen them live, I didn't realise that they're just a blues band.
Basically, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, they're not a psychedelic rock band and all these things. And all that. They play the blues. I was like, so glad I got to see their last ever performance.
Yeah, I remember watching that Live 8 performance. It was really special, and the set list for that was what you would have wanted for like a short kind of set list from those guys. All right, so a tearjerker. You've chosen Joe Goddard, Gabriel. I love this tune so much.
What a tune! Yeah, it's so underrated as well. Mm-hmm. It's I was looking at the video online only before, thinking that's the video to a record like this. Incredible. Mm-hmm. I think it's the tone of the voice.
Yeah.
So ethereal. You know, it's beautiful textures and kind of high, sharp notes to the voice. It's just beautiful. I speak to my friend about it the other day when Dan Ganesha played it last track of Back to Basics once. Mm-hmm. One more tune. Everyone's going nuts in Leeds. And he dropped that, you know, on like dub plate or something, early doors. Never really is that? And it's one of those things, what is that?
Yeah.
You know. I'm going to start playing.
Yeah, it's that, like you say, it stands out as well. That voice on it is so unique,
and it's so spacious as well.
Yeah,
the track.
Yeah, so I mean, you say you can start playing it out again. This leads us on to the next one, which is the last tune. Play one more tune. You know, the crowd are asking for one more. Your answer is great because it's like it depends on, like the event dictates what you're going to play, and completely understand that, which is great. And you know, it's so many times going through this playlist, people are like, are floor fillers are different things for different people? Is it like a warm-up tune that gets people on the dance floor? Is it something that throws everyone's hands in the air? You know, what's the difference with that? Whereas with this last tune, you know, if the event's going to dictate it, how, and you know you're going to play a last tune or close out the event, how are you thinking? What's your thought process coming up to that point? Do you start like, is it just in the moment where you pick that last tune, or do you know where it's going to go and you're like, right, I'm planning the perfect one for this?
Again, it really depends, because if you're in, like, say, Argentina or something and they want to have it last tune, you know, you can play something that's really high energy. And I think I like people leaving brothing at the mouth where possible. You know, I love that. But on the other hand, sometimes it's better to play something that's more emotional or poignant. Mm. Does this Henrik Swartz mix of Roachford work it out, which has stayed under the radar somehow? Mm. And it's incredible. It's like one of the best remixes. It's a vocal record I never leaves my box. It's amazing. So often after a high energy set, I'll play that and let people leave on a kind of more satisfied note. I do remember once, though, after playing Space in Ibiza, I think it was me and Laurent Garnier, and I was closing out in the main room. And again, there's videos online of this, and it was going off, and I had the room absolutely going nuts. And it must have been a Wednesday morning, because it was Tuesday night at Space. Mm-hmm. And what was it, 8 in the morning at least? And I, like, obviously you can see the sunlight coming through the fire doors and stuff. It's like, okay. So I just risked it, and I played Lovely Day by Bill Withers. And you know, I knew what was going to happen. Some people are going to leave like that. Mm-hmm. And some people did.
Yeah.
The people who stayed, which was, you know, about 80% of the people were, it was gorgeous. Mm-hmm. I'll never say that word either. It just was. And they left feeling great.
Yeah.
And then went off and had a lovely day.
And that's it. And yeah, when those doors open and the sun comes through and you're singing that song together with your dance floor brethren at that time, what a moment
it was. And you know, and I've got lots of tunes I like to play last track, but usually it's something that makes people feel something.
Perfect. And this leads us to our final question for the podcast, which is, you know, we are House Culture, you are part of the Club Culture community. We've talked about your career, you've done so much, achieved many things, and you know, made an impact in ways that you never even thought possible. You know, what does club culture and house music culture mean to you? You know, what, aside from everything that we've already talked about, what does it make you feel, and what does it bring you in your life?
Well, I think for me, the one most satisfying part of it is the fact that it's now more, or at least as impactful, if not more, than any other genre of music to ever show up in mankind. Mm-hmm. I thought when it started that it was going to be, it would have a shelf life, maybe like disco.
Yeah.
You know, even though disco kind of floats around, but it's not, if you listen to any of the top 20 records, we strip them back. They're really house music tunes, really, pretty much give or take a couple. So the fact that electronic music is here permanently and the culture is so vast and so wide and so perpetual, it's fantastic. I think sometimes I get confused with the difference between people feeling the way I felt and feel about it in terms of really taking care of its own of the culture and how you made you feel originally, because it's so, as you mentioned earlier, it's so quickly transitional these days, and it's so easily accessible, and that kind of effort to try and find a tune doesn't really exist anymore. You know, you would go to a record shop and search it down for weeks, and eventually hear someone playing it in a club, and that would be the moment, and you did you and all those things that are not quite there, but they're replaced by much more quality, much more exposure, and because of that exposure, it means that the culture's here perpetually, like I say. So yeah, I have warm feelings about the fact that I've been doing this, been my job for 25 years now, and give or take, it's coming up too. So that's not bad. That's not bad at all. And I think from a personal point of view, even though I've chosen to kind of ease off touring a little bit for the minute, because obviously I've got two young children, I want to stay healthy for them. I want to stay healthy full stop. Being on the road is brutal. I stopped partying years and years and years ago, but to keep my enjoyment of what I do, I make sure that I take what I need from it, but whilst constantly contributing to the scene best I can. Yeah. Which it's, I think, really important that people realize that if you want to be like a lifer in this industry, you need to give to it, not take.
That's a brilliant final thought, I think. Thank you so much. That's perfect. That's awesome.
Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
House culture.
Well, I hope you guys appreciated that one as well. I absolutely loved chatting to you, Seb. I think it was great to hear his genuine passion for our scene permeate that entire conversation. Definitely one of our best episodes, I think. Now, if that has enthused you about the man, you can go and catch him play at Rituals in London on the 30th of April 2023. Tickets are available, and if you're lucky, you might even drop his absolutely slamming new single, The Return, which is out now on Abode. It's also available from all of the usual outlets. Whilst we're talking about fat beats, make sure you get yourselves tuned into the House Culture Perfect playlist on Spotify. You heard Yusef drop his choices into what is now an epic selection of supersonics that is now over 30 hours long. So stick it on shuffle, turn it up loud, and you might even hear both of Yusef's last tune choices, which were the beautiful Henrik Schwartz remix of Rochford's Work It Out, the absolute stone-cold classic of Bill Withers' Lovely Day. Just imagine what that must have been like hearing that in space as the sun had just come up. And whilst you're on Spotify, you can now leave us a comment on this episode in the Q&A section just under the episode description on your mobile. So don't be shy, get in touch. And if Spotify isn't your thing, you can also leave us a review on Apple. Get in touch with us on our Instagram page at HouseCultureNet. We always love to hear from you, and we'll give you a shout out on a future episode if you have something nice to say. This time I'd like to say a big hello to Marty OMR on Instagram, who said that after listening to our episode with Judge Jules, that she was at Gatecrasher back in the days that the judge was reminiscing about, and she had some good times. Didn't we all, Marty? It will always be with us. So this is the very end of the episode. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at HouseCultureNet and to follow the hashtag TrueHouseCulture to keep up with all the goings on in the world of house music. And if you want to get in touch with me directly, you can also do that on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. Rave safe. See you next time.
House Culture.
Mom. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.